96-3225, Teresa K. Albert versus A New Healthcare Services, Inc. Representing the healthcare services is Catherine Williams. Ms. Williams?
May I please the court? I am Catherine Williams from Beck, Chait, Mahoney & Bamberger, arguing on behalf of the defendants, respondents, petitioners, A New Healthcare Services, and Sally Springer. This court is being asked this morning to interpret a federal statute, actually two federal statutes, the Americans with Disabilities Act, the ADA, and also Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. At issue is the definition of an employer under these two acts and whether or not that definition imposes personal liability on agents of employers under the ADA and Title VII. In making this determination, this court has to ask itself two questions. The first question is whether or not a plain reading of the definition of an employer under the statutes yields absurd or unjust results, or results that are demonstrably at odds with the intention of the drafters of the statutes. If the answer to this question is yes, then this court must go beyond the plain language of the statutes and considering the scope, history, context, and remedial scheme, particularly the remedial scheme of these statutes, and ask whether the imposition of individual liability under Title VII and the ADA yields absurd and unjust results that are contrary to the intention of the drafters. If the answer to both of these questions, which is essentially, in the final analysis, the same question, is yes, then the Court of Appeals' decision should be reversed. The plaintiff and the Court of Appeals would have the court take a very simple approach and look no further than the plain language of the statute and the definition of an employer. Title VII and the ADA define employer as any person in an industry affecting commerce who has 15 or more employees and any agent of such person. Now, the plaintiff and the Court of Appeals argue that because the statute includes the "and any agent" language, in the definition of an employer, the employer's agents are personally liable for violations under the ADA. It's not that simple. If it were that simple, the 11 Federal Circuit Courts of Appeals that we have cited on page 11 of the respondent's briefs would not have concluded otherwise. I apologize for putting in a full-page footnote in my brief, but I was trying to make a point here. All 11 of the federal circuits that have considered this issue, the only one that hasn't is the First Circuit, have all ruled in thoughtful, well-reasoned, and persuasive decisions. They have all held that individual supervisor agents are not liable under Title VII and the ADA. And interpreting federal law, we're asking this court, we're urging this court to adopt the reasoning of the Federal Circuit Courts of Appeals, particularly the Seventh Circuit decision in EEOC v. AIC Security, which was also an ADA case. If these decisions are persuasive in the interest of comity, this court should adopt the reasoning of the Federal Circuit Courts of Appeals.
Maybe they're wrong.
Pardon?
Maybe they're wrong. I mean, we don't have to adopt them if we disagree with them, right?
No, you don't have to adopt them if you disagree with them. But if they are persuasive and they are well-reasoned and they are grounded in a consideration of the scope of the laws, the history of the laws at issue, and particularly the remedial scheme, then we urge this court to follow the reasoning of the Federal Circuit Court.
Well, my problem is, I just find it hard to accept that if you didn't have, as a defined term, employer, an agent thereof, that there's no respondeat superior. I just can't see how you could. The statute would be worthless unless it was a single individual who owned the company.
No,
and even then, it's worthless.
Why is this? I'm sorry, I'm not understanding. Why do you say the statute is worthless?
I'm saying if employer is defined to include an agent, only for the purposes of respondeat superior.
Correct.
Then if you didn't have that word or agent in, right? Let's just take it out for the moment. And the employer is General Motors. And General Motors can only act through its agents. Does that mean that General Motors isn't liable under the statute?
Of course General Motors is liable because General Motors has employees and General Motors is an employer.
Right.
And it can only act through its agents, and the acts of the agents are the acts of the
right.
corporation, and the corporation is
right.
responsible for
so
the
So what's the
of
point
agents.
Of putting in "and any agent thereof"?
The Supreme Court has answered that, and I believe we've that's addressed in the briefs.
The Supreme Court says that not all the rules of respondeat superior apply to the statutes.
I don't know what that means. What the Supreme Court has said in Meritor Savings and again in the two sexual harassment decisions that were issued last summer, the Farragher and the Burlington Industries versus Elrath cases, is that in those are sexual harassment cases, hostile environment cases. The Supreme Court said that Congress included the "and any agent" language in there to guide the courts in applying agency principles and determining whether or not employers are going to be automatically liable for the acts of their agents. And the Supreme Court has said in some circumstances they may not be. And that is why the Supreme Court has very specifically said that is the reason for inclusion of the "and any agent" language, not to impose personal liability on the individual supervisors. Personal liability does not fit anywhere in the statutory scheme or the remedial sections of Title VII or the ADA. I call the court's attention to the ADA, Section 42 United States Code, Section 12111. If you're going to follow the syllogism used by the Court of Appeals and by the plaintiff, which is the definition of an employer includes an agent, and in this case, defendant Sally Springer is an agent, therefore Sally Springer is an employer and she is liable. If you're going to use that syllogism, then look at the ADA, 42 United States Code, Section 1211. We cited portions of this in our brief. It defines a covered entity under the ADA to include an employer. It defines an employer to include an agent. Therefore, under the ADA, following this logic, an agent is now a covered entity. But Section 12112 of the ADA requires covered entities to reasonably accommodate an employee unless the covered entity can demonstrate that the accommodation would impose an undue hardship on the operation of the business of such covered entity. Now, how does the individual supervisor or employer fit into the reasonable accommodation requirement because they don't operate the business? The corporate entity is the business operation. Secondly, look at the reasonable accommodation requirements. And I call the court's attention, these are set forth at pages 7 and 8 of the amicus brief. Reasonable accommodations, which are required of covered entities and employers under the ADA, include making existing facilities readily accessible, i.e. wheelchair ramps, job restructuring, part-time work schedules, reassignments, acquisition or modifications of equipment or devices, training materials, policies. These are corporate business entity remedies. These are not remedies that individual supervisors can provide.
Do we even get to those provisions? Do we even get to looking at what is a covered entity? Why get to them? We have before us two provisions, the ADA 42 U.S.C. 12111, and even in the Title VII Civil Rights of 1964, which define employer, and define employer as not only a person engaged in commerce who has a certain number of employees working a certain number of calendar weeks, but also defines employer as any agent of such a person. Now you can say, well, you know, they made a mistake, human, they didn't really mean it, but they consistently, in both definitions of employer, have that language. Why do we even get to this other stuff?
We get to it because the responsibilities are placed on the employer. The liability is on the employer. And the responsibilities, the remedies that are placed on the employer don't apply to the employee, which means there was another reason for including that language and any agent. And as I said a few minutes earlier, the Supreme Court has indicated that the reason for including that language is to guide the courts in adopting agency principles.
I haven't read the Supreme Court case or cases that you referred to. But, so I say this with tiptoes, even though I'm sitting. It seems to me that that's kind of a weak argument. Here we have a defendant who is a corporation. A corporation can only speak, act, operate through its agents. So to say that this plain language really that defines employer as an agent really means respondeat superior, which means the company is responsible for the employee's agent's acts, that doesn't make any sense. That's the law. Ask any first-year law student. That's the law. Why do you have to have that phrase in there under the definition of employer?
You do need that phrase because the Supreme Court has held that in some situations the corporation is not responsible for the acts of its employees.
Sure, but it goes to the substantive matters of intent, goes to substantive matters of how far the employee pushes the... Not that they're not liable at all for the employee. They may not be liable because the employee's conduct doesn't match the substantive standard in that statute.
I'm sorry, I'm not understanding the point you're trying to make.
Well, the point I'm trying to make is you may be liable for employees. Your liability for an employee, the range of your liability and the acts for which you're liable may change depending upon the employee's conduct. So an employer is generally liable for the acts of the employee, but if the employee intentionally kills someone, the employer may not be liable for that, even if it's on company property, if the employer had no knowledge or notice of the fact that this guy is going to kill, or has been absolutely not negligent in providing safety for the employees.
That
goes to the substance of the liability. And in these statutes, these federal statutes, the employer is not liable for every single piece of conduct of the employee.
No, at common law under the restatements, which the Supreme Court has said are not necessarily to be applied to Title VII.
That's right, because it's that a different statute.
Right, that you apply them in a practical sense, certainly within the scope of the employer-employee context.
Sure.
There are situations if it's a frolic and detour.
Sure.
Particularly sexual harassment, courts have recognized that that's intentional conduct ostensibly unrelated to any furthering of the employer's interests, which is why the courts recognize some limitations occasionally.
Sure. Under the substantive law.
Under the substantive law.
That's right, but it has nothing to do with the fact that it's an employee, because the GM can only act through employees.
That's correct.
And therefore, if you took out the word employee in that, or agent, you still have GM liable.
And GM should be liable.
That's right.
And in Wisconsin, And this is where I have a real problem with the lack of consistency here. Under Wisconsin's Fair Employment Act, I'm referring to Section 111.39, Wisconsin employers are responsible for the discrimination or discriminatory acts of its employees. Under Wisconsin law, if a plaintiff brings a cause of action for handicap discrimination or sex discrimination or anything under Wisconsin law, he or she can only bring that cause of action against his or her employer, not against the supervisor or the manager who may have engaged in this conduct. Under 111.39, the employer is responsible. As the law stands right now in Wisconsin, under federal law, if you file a cause of action in federal court, this same plaintiff can only bring an ADA claim or a Title VII claim against his or her employer. But right now, that same plaintiff can file the same cause of action under the ADA and Title VII in state court and file it and make claims and receive recovery from both the employer and the individual agent, even though that would not be permissible in federal court in Wisconsin, it would not be permissible in state court in Wisconsin. This is an unjust situation. I would also call the court's attention to the fact that when these statutes were enacted, the only remedies that were available to a prevailing plaintiff were reinstatement and back pay. That evinces an intent on the part of Congress to limit remedies and limit liability to the employing entities who are in a position to pay back pay and to give and to reinstate plaintiffs. Individual supervisors cannot provide these remedies. When the Civil Rights Act of 1991 was passed, it's true that Congress added compensatory damages. But how did Congress do that? It did it with providing a sliding scale of caps on the damages that are available to plaintiffs based upon the size and presumable related resources of the employer. Nowhere in the original Title VII, original ADA, or Civil Rights Act of 1991, is individual liability ever mentioned. It's simply not included. They aren't part of the original remedies. They're not mentioned in 43 United States Code Section 1981A. And the damage caps are limited based upon the number of employers. The statute reads specifically, the sum of the amount of compensatory damages awarded under this section shall not exceed for each complaining party. And then it goes through the four different size of employers. In the case of a respondent who has more than 14 and fewer than 101 employees, $50,000. 100 to 200 employees, $100,000, and et cetera, up to $300,000 if you have more than 500 employees. Nowhere, first of all, an individual doesn't have any employees. The individual doesn't fit in this statutory scheme. Secondly, where and how does it make any sense that an individual supervisor is liable based upon the size of his or her employer? Why does the purchasing manager or the tools department manager in a hardware store that's owned by a large national chain that has more than 500 employees, why is he, if he were found to be personally liable, why would he be liable for up to $300,000 of liability, and the same person who's the purchasing manager or the tools part manager in a small, locally owned department store only be liable for $50,000?
For a moment. Are these mandatory?
No, these are up to these amounts.
So the court can take all that into consideration. The court doesn't have to do that. The court doesn't have to award damages of $50,000 against an agent,
no.
Does it? So it can consider.
The court can adjust the award, certainly in considering the equities and the resources of the defendant,
yeah.
But these awards, first of all, remember that these are only the damages awarded to the plaintiff. There's still the plaintiff's attorney's fees. there's still the defendant's attorney's fees, which could double these amounts easily.
Right.
And obviously,
do,
Congress...
Do any of them have to be awarded? Must the court award attorney fees?
To a prevailing plaintiff in a Title VII or ADA action, the prevailing plaintiff is entitled to recover attorney's fees, yes.
Okay. Now, it seems to me that you're arguing that this statute totally overrules common law doctrine on liability. In an ordinary auto accident, if I'm a corporation and I have an employee and my employee injures somebody negligently with my car, is that employee personally liable for the damages?
Employee should be.
Well, the employee is under general law. The employee is liable. It may also be that the corporation is liable.
Correct.
Because the corporation is liable under respondeat superior. But the corporation may be bankrupt, but that employee may have money. So what you're arguing here is that this statute turns everything around and says the employee, your agent, is not liable. That's what you're arguing. And then all the doctrines of personal liability and tort law don't apply here to this statute.
I am saying that, first of all, under Wisconsin law, the Wisconsin legislature has already said that the employee is not responsible,
Pardon
the employer
me?
Is.
Right.
Okay? And we are saying that under the federal laws, the way Congress has devised the scheme of the federal laws based upon the definition of employer and the way that definition fits within the statutory scheme, the remedial scheme, and the scope of these acts, correct. The employee is not individually or personally liable for his or her conduct that might fall within the scope of Title VII or the ADA.
So it changes the general rules.
I don't think it changes the general rules. I think this is statutory law. Under these circumstances, employees and individual supervisors were never intended to fit into this remedial scheme. They simply don't fit into the reasonable accommodation scheme. They don't fit into, they can't establish undue hardship. They don't operate businesses. They don't employ employees. They don't employ any number of employees, and it makes no sense to make these individuals personally liable to a greater extent or a lesser extent based upon the size and resources of the individual's employers. And based upon the history of the statute, which is very clear in the congressional record, where Congress expressed concern over the ability of small employers in this country to be able to afford not only potential liability, but even the cost of defense of these actions, it excluded employers who have fewer than 15 employees. They are excluded completely. A plaintiff who works for an employer who has fewer than 15 employees cannot bring a claim under Title VII or the ADA. And at the time Title VII was enacted in 1964, based upon my research, only 9 states had fair employment laws, which means Congress knew, and Congress has known throughout setting up this entire remedial scheme, there are going to be situations where a plaintiff may not have a remedy. And the remedies are scaled on the basis of the size of the employer and the resources of the employer. Individual supervisors simply do not fit into the statutory scheme. For these reasons, we request that this court reverse the decision of the Court of Appeals and find that individual supervisor agents are not personally liable under Title VII and the ADA. Thank you.
Thank you.
Could I ask a question?
Yes, Mr.
Professor. Could you clarify for me what the impact of the ADA is on state and local governments?
On
state and local governments? Does it apply to them?
In other words, does this court have to apply with the ADA?
You know, standing here right now, I'm not going to answer that question because I'm not sure. Yes, I do believe some of the principles of the ADA apply to federal government. Perhaps Mr. Ullman can answer that question, but I'm sorry, I'm not sure.
He's averting his eyes as well.
He's, pardon? He's rolling his eyes as well? Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Ullman, representing the plaintiff, Ms. Albert. You can raise the podium if you wish. These oral arguments are not only heard but recorded.
I think that is in compliance with the ADA here. May it please the court, my name is John Ullman, and I'm representing the plaintiff appellant Lisa Alberti, who is responding to the petition for review. Based upon the petitioner's argument, it seems to me that one could characterize the issue before this court as follows. Did Congress really mean what it said when it defined the term employer as including any agent of a person engaged in an industry affecting commerce who has 15 or more employees? And as suggested by the way I posed the issue, I think to reach the conclusion being advocated by the petitioner here requires one not only to ignore some of the primary rules of statutory construction that this court and the Supreme Court has used to interpret statutory language, but to make inferences that are just the opposite of what these rules would normally call for. To illustrate these points, if we turn to the first rule of statutory construction, that rule requires us to examine the language to ascertain whether it is ambiguous. If the language is unambiguous, the statute is interpreted in accordance with the plain meaning of the language being used. Curiously, here we have a case where everyone, virtually everyone, acknowledges that the language is not ambiguous, and the plain meaning of the words would require a construction of the statute allowing a case to proceed against the employing entity and its agents. Nevertheless, we are told we must ignore this plain meaning. So we begin the analysis by being told that we should ignore the clear and unambiguous language. The rule is telling us one thing, and the petitioners here are telling us just the opposite. The petitioners have relied upon a Supreme Court decision in Griffin versus Oceanic Contractors to support their view that it is possible to ignore unambiguous statutory language. And I think if you look at Griffin, you would find that indeed the court did acknowledge, at least in theory, that it would be possible to disregard clear and unambiguous language in the rare case or the extraordinary circumstance where literal application of the statute is demonstrably at odds with the intent of the drafters. But the problem with the petitioner's reliance upon Griffin is that in the case before the court decided not that the case before it was not the extraordinary circumstance or the rare case. And if you look at the facts of Griffin, I think they're instructive. I mean, in Griffin, we had a statute, we had a situation where a sailor had unpaid wages of $412. And he demanded over $300,000 based upon a statute requiring payment of 2 days' pay from each and every day that payment was delayed. And the court rejected the idea that this was an absurd and unjust result, that, or this was the rare case or extraordinary circumstance. And it applied the literal language of the statute.
The problem I have is that that it's clearly absurd. That's the problem I have. So what are we supposed to do? If this were state legislation and I had, I'm exaggerating for emphasis a little bit, but not much. If I had clearly absurd language and this were state legislation, I'd say, take care of it, state legislature, and I'd send it back. But the language may be clear, but to interpret it that way is arguably absurd. So what do you do? So what are we supposed to do?
I guess I don't agree with the first point that the language is absurd. I guess you mean the language in Griffin you're talking about, or the language in this statute?
In this statute I'm talking about.
Well,
let me say, it seems to me, again, maybe exaggeration for emphasis, but your opposing counsel uses the term absurd. Let me use problematic. It's problematic that the state of Wisconsin, I think, will be the only jurisdiction where a plaintiff can sue the individual under federal legislation. And all they have to do is go down the street to this federal district court, and it would be true in any federal district court that's addressed this issue of what this federal legislation means. It's problematic, some of the arguments of your opposing counsel, that how can you say that individual employees and agents fit within the remedy scheme? The agents don't have any employees, and there's a list of things that I could go on with that make it very problematic to go along with your interpretation.
Well, first of all, let me address, I think if this case was in the Fourth Circuit or in the First Circuit, Ms. Springer would not have been dismissed. The rule in the Fourth Circuit, which I cited in the briefs, has to do with if the agent is the decision maker. That is, he's not merely carrying out a delegated duty from the employer, but the agent is personally liable.
What case are you talking about in the Fourth Circuit?
The Fourth Circuit case would be, I cited the Shoemaker versus Metro Information Service, which is 910 F sub 259. It's cited.
What year is that?
That is a 1996 case, and that was a district court case relying upon the language in Paroline versus Unisys Corporation and Burbick versus Marble Lighting Corporation. So I think that's, as far as I know, that's still the law in the Fourth Circuit. The First Circuit, of course, it's an open question. The district courts, I mean, if you're in the district court in the First Circuit, Ms. Springer would not have been dismissed. And the district courts are leaning towards the interpretation that I'm advocating here.
In the same line with the question of Justice Bradley, it seems to me, and I'm just looking at, all these limitations, 14 or fewer, well, that means if you have more than 15 employees, and then you go up to the next category, which is 100 or more, and then you go up to 200 or more. Now, obviously, just reading that, it would seem that it wouldn't make any sense that Congress would limit the statute's application to people that employ 15 or more, and then come back to, well, you're individually liable. What's the reason for the limitations then?
Well, I think the problem with the argument about the limitations is that it's hard to defend no matter how you look at it. I mean, if you're the plaintiff and you have two people who are injured exactly the same, one of them works for an employer who employs 49 people, and one of them works for an employer that employs 51 people, one has a $50,000 cap and the other one has a $100,000 cap.
And that's the way they did it, right?
Right. I mean, it's very hard to defend the scheme altogether in terms of whether it makes any sense.
It's a scheme. This is what is set up. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah. Well,
and then to plop it back or put it back on the individual.
The question is, normally what we look at is to try to reconcile the statutory language. And is it possible to reconcile this language? And I think, as the Court of Appeals clearly indicated, it is very easy to reconcile it. I mean, it's very clear what the limits are for the individual. It depends upon the size of the employing entity using that damage scheme. I think if you look at the other aspect, this is a statute that has very broad remedial measures. It includes broad equitable relief. And one of the arguments that...
I'm sorry. You're going to have to stand in front of the microphone.
I'm sorry.
So what you're saying, if I understand your argument, if you work for someone who has 14 to 101, your liability, individual liability is $50,000. If you work for someone who has 100 or more, it's $100,000. But if you work for someone who has 7, there isn't any individual liability because that's excluded. Now, does that make any sense?
Well, it's excluded under the Act.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, the Act itself, the structure of the Act is that there's concurrent jurisdiction. I mean, the Congress did not come in and say, we're going to prevent anyone from, we're not going to preempt this field. And so what's the curious part, I think, about the argument is that what Congress said is that it carved out a very special area for the states to regulate it. And in certain states, in fact, the remedy is greater. In Michigan and in California, where there are no caps on compensatory damages, and it doesn't matter how many employees that you have, you can collect more under the state statute than you can under the federal statute. So this wasn't a clear intention to protect small employers. If it was, they would have preempted the field.
Can I ask you a question about the agent? In a new healthcare services, Inc., we have Sally Springer. But suppose Sally Springer acted to discharge Lisa Alberti after a meeting of the board of directors. They discussed the discharge. Could all of the members of the board of directors be agents?
Well, again, the question is, who is the decision maker? I think that, again, we have to go back to our common law. I think the common law rules, and I think the board acting as a board is probably not individually liable.
What if they directed?
Well, then I don't think you have any difference between the board of directors and the employer as a practical matter.
If a fellow employee said, Sally, you got to get rid of Lisa, would that person be an agent?
Well, of course, the question of who's an agent is not before us, because it's conceded that this person is an agent. And that was, in a sense, the issue that the Supreme Court addressed in Farragher in the cases cited by the petitioner here. I mean, the agent has to actually, following Farragher, the agent actually has to act in the capacity of the agent. That is, do some act on behalf of the employer. That is, fire, discharge. So to demonstrate that there is, in fact, an agency status. So that the co-employee making a statement on the side who is not, in fact, engaged in any type of active conduct is not an agent of the statute. But this, in this case, it's conceded that it's conceded in the answer that Sally Springer is an agent. So I would agree with you. If there is some ambiguity in the statute, it's in, well, who is an agent? And that was really the issue that the Supreme Court addressed in Farragher. But getting back to the point about equity, I mean, what I think is curious about the petitioner's argument is that normally when we talk of this act originally provided, or Title VII originally provided for equitable relief alone. And equitable relief is generally relief in persona. In other words, the way courts of equity, the way that they enforced an order was against a person, a real person. And the only power they had was to either a contempt power, that is, put jail the person, a natural person. And that was when we're talking about equity jurisdiction, I think the presumption is in persona as opposed to in rem or some other way. And so when you look at the broad remedial purposes of the Act, both under Title VII and the ADA, when we're talking about an equitable order addressed to specific conduct, it makes sense that the agency language would be interpreted to apply against natural persons as opposed to just against artificial persons created by the statute. The problem I can also see with the argument concerning the statutory scheme is that the petitioners really argue it both ways. On the one hand, they argue that since Title VII originally just had equitable relief, that indicated a congressional intent not to include agents as being personally liable. On the other hand, they argue that when Congress amended the statute and provided for compensatory and punitive relief, that also indicated an intent not to include the individuals within the liability scheme. And I don't think you can maintain both of those arguments logically. I think the question is whether or not there's clear and convincing evidence that Congress did not mean what it said or said what it meant when it defined agent as including within the definition of employer. And If you accept that as the standard, I think it's very difficult to reach the conclusions that the petitioners have advocated, because there simply is no clear and convincing proof here regarding what the intent is. To believe that Congress would have passed a law that would not have allowed it to reach an agent in cases where the agent is clearly the deciding person, and who is the person against whom equitable relief would be make the most sense, it seems to me a misreading of the statute, and it certainly would not be consistent with at least one of the purposes of the statute.
Counsel, we have presented to us under cover of letter October 26, 1999, the Hiller case out of the Sixth Circuit, and that's a case that was decided the end of May 29th of this year, adding yet another case to be cited by your opponent that the Federal Circuit Courts of Appeal are in lockstep, she maintains. You seem to suggest that the trend is, and I may be misheard you, the trend of the district courts is to the contrary. Yet how can that be the trend when the Federal Circuit courts continue in lockstep, most recently this decision of May 29th?
If that's what you heard me to say, that was not what my intent was. And what I said is in the First Circuit, the trend was that the district courts was defined to accept the interpretation that I've been adopting here.
In all other circuits, is it correct to say, in all other circuits, the trend of the district court is to be consistent with their circuit court of appeals?
Well, that's fair to say. Of course, if you look at what the trend was before the decision was made in the court of appeals, it was a very contentious issue in every circuit. I think that from my perspective, what I see this is to be a Johnson Controls situation. In Johnson Controls, the Seventh Circuit adopted, or at least found, that a fetal protection policy was consistent with the language in Title VII. And the Supreme Court unanimously reversed that opinion. And it seems what drove the Court of Appeals to the conclusion that it reached was its belief that that was a good policy.
Yeah, but in the Seventh Circuit, you have the AIC case, which is one of the few that directly addresses individual liability under the ADA as opposed to the civil rights, and they come down against you.
Well, I am not saying that they do, but what I'm saying is that the reason I'm citing is that in the Johnson Controls case, the Seventh Circuit went one way, and the Supreme Court unanimously refused to adopt the reasoning. And I think it's the same reasoning here. What drove the opinion in Johnson Controls was a belief that this is what the policy should be, that employers should be allowed to protect fetuses and should be able to enact fetal protection policies. But it just is not consistent with the language of the statute, and there wasn't a single justice of the Supreme Court that was willing to accept to ignore the plain language of the statute. And I think that's the same situation we have here. I think the issue is being driven by a belief that what the policy should be, as opposed to what Congress chose this to be the policy and what the language says.
Could I ask you what the impact of the ADA is on state and local governments? The same question I asked.
Well, state and local governments are covered by the ADA. They're within the definition of employers.
All right. So, just hypothetically, suppose the chief discharges an employee improperly in violation of the ADA. Is the state going to, well, does she have some sort of immunity, or, what's the impact? Would the state pick up the cost?
Well, the hypothetical is a little problematic because there are these cases that the question of whether judiciary within the definition of a state employer is, and there are those cases kind of go over the
let's
place.
Let's go to something okay. less sensational.
Department of Administration.
Ooh.
As a practical matter, when you're talking about the state, it really doesn't make any difference on the issue. Because obviously if it's a choice between pockets, between the state and the individual, the state, as a plaintiff's attorney, You know, I'm going to be aiming at the state, not at the individual. I mean, it makes no sense for me to do that.
But there are provisions in the state statute for indemnifying employees from liability.
And I think the assumption is that, and in fact the common law assumption is that the agent would be indemnified by the employer. I mean, when we're talking about whether it's the truck driver or anyone else, that if he's acting within the scope of his employment, normally the employer is the indemnifier. But I think the question goes to what the jurisdiction of the court should be in the remedy that's being, at least what the potential remedy might be. And to say that the court cannot reach the individual who may be making the decisions seems to me a result that is just contrary to the very intent of the legislation. And I think that when we hear this parade of horribles, I mean, some of it really doesn't make any sense because the Act doesn't say that every agent is liable. It really depends on what type of employment action we're talking about and whether or not it makes sense to hold that particular agent liable for the claim being made.
In light of the indemnification that you state, why are we fussing in this case? I mean, why is everybody making such a big deal out of it? The deep pocket's going to be the corporation in most instances. I mean, you may have a defunct corporation. As to the employee, there's indemnification unless you have a defunct corporation. So, except for the defunct corporation, why do we have this before us?
Well, I think you have it for the same reason that the issue came up in the Seventh Circuit in AIC, and that is when we're talking about closely held corporations in which there's one individual who controls the assets, and when we're talking about a service corporation or one of these e-commerce corporations, these internet that has no physical assets, and it's very easy for that corporation to avoid judgment. So that's why that issue is here. I mean, that's why at least it was important to my client to keep the president and majority stockholder in as a party who made the decision against her.
Sort of like piercing the corporate veil.
Well, of course, I mean,
you
but
don't
that,
want to get into that.
Well, I that's what the language of the statute seems to suggest was the intent of Congress, that by putting in the agent language that they weren't going to allow a corporation or an employing entity to be hide behind the veil.
So your view is that 11 circuits have held against you because you think they're making law and public policy rather than applying the clear words of the statute. Is that your position in a nutshell?
I think it is. I mean, it's very hard when they begin with the decision saying the language is clear and unambiguous. Where else are they going? Why else? I cannot figure out any other way that they're reaching that conclusion.
And the intent of the legislature, where is that set forth clearly that these 11 circuits can find that intent?
Well, it's a very curious approach. I mean, I don't think it's one that as far as I can tell, the Supreme Court has ever adopted. What they've said is that they use a variation of what would be called the context approach. I think normally when we talk about putting statutory language in context, what we're looking at is to whether or not the original language is ambiguous. So that, for instance, I think the example going back to Blackstone was of a statute of Edward III in which clerics were prohibited from buying provisions at Rome. And what he argues is that you have to look at the whole context of the statute and the title of the statute before you would realize that when they were talking about provisions, they were talking about church offices. And so there was kind of a latent ambiguity in the statute itself in using the word provisions, which you might not appreciate unless you put the language in context.
Where did you find that?
That's in Blackstone and commentaries on the Law of England. I think it's on page 56, if I remember right. So.
What paragraph?
What edition? That's even more important.
Okay. Thank you.
I think but here we're not looking at any language. The petitioners aren't saying that there's a phrase here or there's a clause here that's ambiguous. I mean, they concede that if you read the statute, that the language is clear and unambiguous. And so I don't think... That's where I have a problem with the context approach. And then the approach that normally that you take is that you try to reconcile the sections of the statute. And it seems that just the opposite approach is being taken, that rather than trying to reconcile the sections, there's an attempt to show how you can't reconcile them when they easily can be. I mean, I think the numerous decisions that have been able to reconcile it demonstrate that you can reconcile all these sections and make it sensible. So that's where I see the problem in the, at least the framework being used to reach the conclusions that were reached by the circuits that have ruled that way. And the other point I think that it's important to make is that there was a very serious concern with the Commerce Clause. When you talk about where this 15-person limit came from, if you go back to the history, if you go back to the language, it's very clear that Congress had a concern about what would be perceived as being a legitimate exercise of power under the Commerce Clause. And particularly when you're dealing with this area, which is the area of labor legislation, this is an area which was traditionally an area in which the states had exclusive jurisdiction. It was not that long ago where the Supreme Court refused to recognize federal labor legislation. So when Congress came in and started passing legislation in this area, the concern clearly was with what would be perceived as a reasonable exercise of power under the Commerce Clause, and that's reflected both in the statutory language and in the statutory history. As I indicated before, although they were concerned about that, they did not preempt the field.
Let me ask, is this case ever going to be heard again in state court? Let me say the answer is no. We'll never have another one of these ever, ever, ever again, unless someone makes a mistake. Because these are all going to be, by the defendant, removed to federal court. And then the law is darn clear. The defendant tried, in this case, to do that, but because of a timing problem, and I think it might have been in connection with this Murphy case that just came out that changed the timing, you know, so that's why we're here, because Murphy, because of timing. But absent that, this case will most likely have, I'm asking this, will most likely have no future effect, because any defense attorney is going to, within hours of receipt, move to go to a federal court. Move to federal court. Am I right?
You may be right. Since most of my practice is in this area, I can tell you that doesn't happen all the time. There are defense lawyers who prefer the state court.
But if there was an individual that was sued, they'd be right there, right away. I mean, it would be, as I say, problematic for the defense attorney not to go to remove to federal court if he was representing or she was representing an individual defendant. Wouldn't you agree with that?
I agree.
Tantamount to malpractice, I would guess.
But, you know, the interesting part about that is that Congress gave jurisdiction to both the state courts and the federal courts.
Yes.
You know, so they did not say that the federal courts have exclusive jurisdiction.
And that's no problem, as long as you don't have this individual error, this agent issue.
Right. Well, but the other point that I was trying to make is that I think Congress, when they made that decision, that not to give, exclusive jurisdiction to the federal courts, obviously it contemplated this scenario where it is possible that the state courts may rule differently than the federal courts, and that would be good for the law. It would be good that the state should have an input in terms of how these laws are interpreted. And in fact, the whole enforcement scheme of the statute is designed that way, from the mandate that the charge be filed with the local agency, with the local state agency, as opposed to in a processing time for the local agency. I mean, it was all designed to have state input into both every aspect of it, including the enforcement aspect.
You view it as a federalism case, then?
Yes, certainly. I mean, I think I think it would be good for this statute to, at least for this decision, to be analyzed more carefully by the Supreme Court. I mean, and I would say this court has a long tradition of adopting the better reasoned approach as opposed to the most popular approach. And that's kind of the tradition that I'm pitching this to.
Thank you.
Oh. There's a question. Good.
In conclusion, I mean, if we do the analysis suggested by the petitioners, I think we end up where we began. That is, we can look at the other language in the statute, and we can look at the legislative history, but when we do so, we find that there is no clear proof that Congress did not say what it meant and meant what it said. To paraphrase Justice Frankfurter, when the legislative history is in doubt, we should look to the statute for guidance. And on behalf of the plaintiff appellant, I respectfully urge the court to apply the statute as written and to affirm the decision of the Court of Appeals.
Thank you, Mr. Ullman. Ms. Williams, you have 5 minutes to rebuttal.
I'd like to address the last point made by Justice Bradley first. You will have at least one other case heard in state court. Defendants can't always remove cases. There are circumstances where, we're here for one, even though the Supreme Court later indicated that we did remove this on a timely basis back in 1994-95. I did receive a call just a few weeks ago from an attorney who wanted copies of the briefs in this case because she was one representing one of multiple defendants, and under the removal statute, if any of the defendants fail to remove on a timely basis or join in the removal on a timely basis, you may end up in state court. The whole thing stays in state court, and that was what happened to her. So, yes, there is a reason for issuing a decision in this case and making it a well-reasoned decision that conforms with state law and federal law, because these cases may end up in state court under a number of circumstances. Going back to a couple of the points that Attorney Ullman made, we cited the Oceana Contractors case for the basic principle that you do look beyond the plain language of a statute. If the results of the plain language reading are absurd, or as Justice Walsh would prefer, problematic, and in this case, I think we have shown in numerous ways that the results of imposing individual liabilities under the statute are problematic. The Wisconsin Court of Appeals, in the In re Abigail adoption of Abigail M case, which we have cited, has held that there's room for judicial construction of a portion of a statute, even though it's plain and unambiguous, where to give it a literal meaning would produce absurd results or frustrate the legislative purpose. I think that's what we have here. And the plaintiff has not answered, nor did the Court of Appeals in its decision ever answer or explain why these results aren't absurd or problematic. They are. They don't identify where in the statutes individual liability was intended to apply under this scheme and the remedial scheme of the statutes. I also, going back to the original relief that was provided by Title VII and the ADA, the original remedies I would not characterize as equitable. The original remedies were back pay and reinstatement. These are not the types of remedies that are necessary in personam. It's the corporation that has to reinstate the employee. It would be the corporation that would have to pay the back pay to the employee, because it's the corporation that's paying the employee. And the respondents are not arguing it both ways on the statutory scheme, because even though compensatory damages were added in 1991, this didn't frustrate the original scheme or the original intent of Congress. Number one, the small employers were still exempt. Small employers were exempt in 1964. They were still exempt in 1991. And when they added the compensative and punitive damages, as we've discussed, they added them based upon the size and resources of the employers. So the concern of Congress, which was to not overburden small employers with the cost of defense and the cost of these lawsuits, was still intact when the Civil Rights Act of 1991 was passed, and the two positions are consistent, and Congress was consistent when it added the compensatory damages. I would also like to point out the Hiller case that was filed with the court about a month ago, because this was the Sixth Circuit case, the only case I found where the plain language argument was made again to a federal court, arguing that the plain language in this case under the Rehabilitation Act of 1973, where a person is defined as an individual, and the court said, while the plain language interpretation has some surface appeal, the district court didn't resolve the question of liability because it frustrated the statutory scheme and the remedial purposes of the act, and that's exactly what we have here. The court resisted the temptation to go with the surface appeal of the plain language argument, looked at the remedial scheme and the purposes of the act, and went beyond the literal language of the statute to determine what the intent of Congress was. The plaintiff has, quite simply, and the Court of Appeals did the same thing. They say that the arguments made by the Seventh Circuit in AIC Security, the arguments that we've made here and in our briefs to this court, do not justify the construction of the statute which ignores the statute's plain language. It is our position that the arguments that we made, the results that would occur if personal liability were imposed, do frustrate the purpose of the statute, and for those reasons, the Court of Appeals' decision should be reversed. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Williams. Thank you, Mr. Ullman. The court's in recess until 1:45, and we'll hear our third case. The students are going to be staying here in meeting with Justice Bradley.